All right, this is tape two of the interview, and you're in North Carolina, South Carolina.
Right, in Greensboro, North Carolina. The students at North Carolina A&M had gone to Woolworths and asked for a Coke, which of course was against the law and against Woolworths policy. I'm not sure which was more stringent. They were thrown out, went back the next day and beaten up and then thrown out. And I decided they shouldn't be in this thing by themselves. We had a Woolworths here in Madison. What better way of helping their cause could I find than to initiate a picket line out front of Woolworths here, hoping to scare away business and thereby put some economic pressure on the Woolworths chain. And it never occurred to me that anybody might oppose this. It was the moral thing to do, the pragmatic thing to do. So let's do it. I got on the phone and brought a bunch of people up to date on what had been going on. Scheduled it for Saturday. And Friday night, I got an incredibly worried phone call from one of the leaders of the socialist movement on campus, one of the older ones, who was very concerned that the picket line, because the people who would be out there picketing Woolworths would not be trained in nonviolence, that the thing might erupt in violence. He was a little more in tune with the various publications that had been writing about some of the philosophies behind the movements of this sort. And wanted the whole event called off for fear that it would become violent. And I was dead certain that there would be no violence. And simply said, it will be, and it was. It brought out, oh, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 people, and we had signs and...
Students.
All students, yes. And I think there was one black student there. And it made an instant box office hit. It got into the local papers, it got into the Daily Cardinal. And when we announced there would be another one the following Saturday, but not just at Woolworths, but by this time the Greensboro movement had spread to the other similar chains, H.L. Green's, I believe it was, and Cress. There was one on each corner of the square. So we decided, well, maybe we can get enough people out. We'll pick at all three. And we did. We had enough people. And we said, gee, this is going very well. So we started organizing. We were pragmatic enough to realize we could not sustain any sort of movement in Madison, and certainly not on campus, of socialists. The standing joke, of course, was that all the socialists were getting married and having children because we couldn't recruit any members. We had to raise our own from within. And we had gotten some of the Human Relations Committee people down. I was a member that year, I believe, but not in any leadership capacity. And the Student Governments Committee then picked up the ball that we had started in motion. And fronted for it, essentially. The meetings were inevitably held in our living room.
The meetings of the picketers.
The meetings of the planners for the pickets, which consisted of about half a dozen of the Student Government Human Relations Committee, and about a half a dozen of the Socialist Club members. And it kept getting larger and larger, and pretty quick these planning meetings outgrew our living room, so we had to actually move it into the student union to hold the meetings. Very quickly, as memory serves me, the pickets covered all of the three stores, the Woolworths, Kresge's, and Green's. And they were daily, not just Saturdays. And they were fairly large. After the first or second weekend, we started getting some solidification of the opposition, the most noticeable of them was a gentleman named Taliaferro, who was head of the Madison and NAACP at the time. He was also a lecture assistant at the chemistry department. And he either was interviewed or wrote, I think it was a letter to the editor of one of the two student, one of the two Madison newspapers, disavowing any NAACP interest in what we had been doing, and said it was the wrong thing, and he apologized to Woolworths. I think it was about 1 or 2 weeks later, he wrote a second letter apologizing to us publicly. He was very open about it, and said he had been wrong, and thanked us for, you know, helping get the thing going, and joined us. And
what accounted for his change of heart?
Oh, there was a national change of heart by then. The national NAACP realized what was going on, realized they either had to join it or be left behind by it. They could not stop it. I don't think they wanted to stop it by then. And so he was assured that it was, you know, was all right. And by that time, they could not have stopped it, because within the space of, seems like barely a few weeks, it could not have been more than a few months, the entire movement had just assumed breakneck momentum. The movement here seemed to be, you know, totally isolated. It was spontaneous. It was in reaction to events we had only a fuzzy sense of from news items what was going on. And we did what we could do, and then we started hearing at other campuses they were doing the same. And being students and being organizers, we of course said, well, gee, let's all get together. So we started getting together, often by mail and often by telephone, sometimes face to face, with students from the other northern campuses.
You were directly involved in this, were you?
I stayed directly uninvolved because I was then president of the Socialist Club and had enough sense by then to know that I could have been a leper in this colony and did not want to jeopardize it, so that although I was very active in the meetings and again, because of my naive instincts, was looked to for some of the directives as to ways we might best pursue this, I was generally not involved in any of the public pronouncements or the speeches. When there were rallies, the only time I would speak would be if there were a lot of other people. I would never ever be just one of two or three people speaking. And very quickly, there was no need for it, because the thing had gotten started and there were so many people with so much more time and energy than I had by that time. I was a senior and a father and working one or two jobs and trying to finish up all of my research papers for all these professors I owed papers to. And, you know, it was very comforting to know that what had gotten started was being carried along with a lot of momentum, and I didn't have to be very active on an hour-by-hour basis, although I think there were meetings almost every day for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Say again, what period, what months were we talking about?
They were, must have been the fall of the 59-60 school year, because I remember some of the photographs. I was quite a photographer by then. I remember some of the photographs, and people were wearing coats but not bundled up for winter yet during some of our demonstrations.
Were any faculty members joining in?
Absolutely not. This was the end of the McCarthy days, and they were all feeling, my God, I made it through McCarthy. McCarthy had already died, but his memory was still there. And
but this wasn't a communist issue.
No, but it was something out of the ordinary, politically and socially. I do remember a sociology professor whose classes I had taken two or three times was on his way to the state capitol one Saturday morning during our second or maybe first picket out front of Woolworths, and was crossing the street to get to the capitol and noticed what was going on, and being a sociologist stopped to observe, of course, but not participate. Recognized me and said, oh, hi, it's a great thing you're doing. I said, well, come on, join us. Oh, no, I've got to go here to the Capitol. There were no faculty involved.
Did you ever discuss it with Bill Williams?
It wasn't his issue. I don't think anybody ever discussed it with Williams.
What about, let's see, Bill Rice was somebody who was very involved in civil rights. Maybe later, I don't know.
Yeah, I think we had talked with Rice. We had spoken to Williams. Yes, we had. He was one of the speakers at one of the rallies, I remember. I have one of the large rallies was a march from the mall between the historical and memorial libraries to the state capitol. And since we had been one of the instigators of the northern front of the movement, Life magazine came to town to cover it here, even though it was a nationally coordinated march. And I remember Bill Williams jogging home afterwards. He was one of the first joggers I ever knew, and he had been one of the speakers at the rally. Rice was one of the people who advised, but again didn't participate. There was another one involved.
Merle Curdy, by any chance?
Merle Curdy was not, no. Mossy, of course, was there rooting in the wings, but was always very busy with other things. Anything having to do with political turmoil or demonstrations was right up his alley. I'll digress because it's such a story that can't be lost in case you don't already have it on tape. It's got to be absolutely true, even though I did not hear it from Mossy. He was showing a European friend of his around campus one evening when suddenly the police sirens and police lights and helmeted policemen are running all over the place with clubs in their hands, and the screaming, and the students are screaming, and there's water all over the place. And the friend says to Mossy, oh, he says, Professor Mossy, a political demonstration. And Mossy says, no, it's just the fraternity boys having a water fight. That story made the rounds for at least a year or two, showing how little political activity there was. We here referred to that period of time between 56 and 60, as we worked in two different cliches, the angry young men from the silent generation. That was how we pictured the image of ourselves. In fact, in the campus literary magazine, be 59 or 60, there was, I believe, an article that I wrote with that title. Wouldn't swear to it. I remember writing it, and I remember vividly the editor, I guess I could go back and check whether they did in fact publish or not. If not, I no doubt I have it. But that was the way that the would-be and open radicals at that time pictured themselves. This was the silent generation. We were the angry young men at that time. We referred to women and men and everybody else as men.
Did any of the deans
I don't suppose you had much to do with Martha Peterson, since she was the Dean of Women.
It's an interesting story about her, too. Again, it has to be true because it was so oft repeated. We were interested in getting rid of the student curfews. Women in those days had to be protected, of course, and they had to be in at 9:30, I believe it was, on weekdays, and I think it was 11:30 on weekends. And we just didn't find it to be very fair at all, so we were trying to force legislation through the administration to get rid of that. And the legend is that somebody said to Martha Peterson, well, what is it that the students can do after 9:30 that they can't do before 9:30? And she just grinned and said they can do it again. And that story made the rounds of just one student after another for years and years until they finally got rid of the curfew.
She was popular.
Yes.
But none of the deans didn't attempt to interfere, or Zillman, I suppose, was dean then.
Yeah, Zillman was dean of men, and Luberg was dean of students.
Yeah.
We kept away from the university as much as possible. We formed an ad hoc committee and stayed. That's why we stayed out of the union.
Okay.
After we outgrew our living room on Brook Street, we moved into a non-campus building to hold a meeting because we did not want to risk the university stifling it. Everybody, including the members of the student government, not just the Socialist Club, but the members of the student government likewise, were very nervous that the administration would try to stifle it and stop it. So we never formed it as a student organization. The Human Relations Committee was simply a member of this ad hoc committee on whatever it was we called it. Mm-hmm. And therefore kept it a community and not a campus project. And since we very carefully kept the demonstrations on public grounds and not particularly university grounds, the university could do nothing about it, mm-hmm. and did not try. Mm-hmm. This one march was down what was then State Street, is now partly the mall. That was all public. We got a permit from the city and not from the university. And all of the other demonstrations were held off campus. Mm-hmm. The meetings were all held off campus. The coalition of students from the various northern universities were, for the most part, the most active of the campus leaders, at least the social activists. And led to a relatively permanent, although again ad hoc, coalition of students that was eventually named the Northern Student Movement. To keep it separate from the Southern Student Movement. The Southern Student Movement were those who were going into Woolworths and the likes and getting beat up and thrown in jail and thrown out of school. And the Northern Student Movement, for the most part, was a support group. It began small enough, simply a telephone network. A few selected people would telephone the southern campuses, reach the leaders there to find out what had gone on that day, because the news media was not covering it then. This was not an Edward R. Murrow, you are there. You weren't there. You were not in the front pages. You were not in the back pages. Nobody wanted to write about what was going on down there. So we would telephone to find out what was going on and then relay information to other campuses in the north, and they would in turn get it into the campus papers.
Were you still not doing this yourself directly?
I was involved in the planning of it. I stayed out of the forefront of it. Part of the need was for money, whether it be for just supporting the movement or for bail. We designated one day on campus as fundraising day for the movement. And we were to each member give a fundraising pitch in all of our classes that day. The faculty were 95% sympathetic, either remained neutral or unhostile and allowed it. I remember that I was taking a seminar type course, but a very large seminar type. It wasn't it was on contemporary issues, and it was largely designed for the engineering type students who wouldn't read the newspapers, so this was an attempt to force them to face what was going on today in the humanities and in the news and in the sciences.
And you're not talking about contemporary trends, are you?
It may have had that title. It was taught down in the engineering campus, so.
No, then it wasn't.
No. They deliberately put it on the engineering campus because it was a strongly recommended course for engineers. I signed up for it because I wanted to make up for some of my lacking in hard information about some of the social trends at the time. One of the other people who had signed up for it for somewhat the same reason was Bill Steiger, who was a young Republican and a very conservative student leader, who eventually became a representative from Wisconsin. We stayed in touch, making jibes at each other over, by the time he got to be a freshman Republican member of the House of Representatives, he was considered very liberal among his peers. So I sort of rubbed that into him, and he would always, every time he would come across something that I had written that was anything but radical, he would always say, yeah, ha ha, well, you too. he died, I guess, 5-10 years ago, suddenly. But after this long lead-up, it was one of my first direct tastes with how unpopular this Southern movement was. It was fundraising day. That was the class I was in at that time. I forget who was chairing it, but he said, well, go ask the professor who was to be the speaker that day. It was a different speaker each day. The speaker was Gilchrist from the psychology department, whose class, interestingly enough, I had taken at least once and knew him to be a stalwart liberal, always preaching about how environmental causes were responsible for our psyche and not any of this genetic stuff. That was the current fad then. So he said, oh, fine, yes, by all means, give your pitch. So I naively began by introducing myself and pointing out a few of the events that had been going on in North Carolina and Tennessee and Georgia and Alabama, and that's about as far as I got that I could be heard. The hissing and the booing was more frightening and more intimidating than anything I'd ever seen in a movie out of Nazi Germany or out of anywhere else. These engineers did not want anything to do with this. Absolutely not. They didn't want to hear about it. They didn't want to think about it. They didn't want me to talk about it. And this was a large auditorium. This was, must have been 1,000 students in this auditorium. So it was quite a tumult. That was one of the days of my life where I learned that the morality, or as I view the morality of a cause, doesn't necessarily make it right in anybody else's eyes.
What did Gilchrist do about that?
Nothing. He was very philosophical, made mental notes for his class in social psychology, no doubt, and that was that. I guess I would have expected him to at least have been sympathetic. Obviously, it was not a pleasant experience. In fact, it was downright traumatic to stand there thinking you had something to say and be faced by 1,000 hostile voices. The fundraising went better in other parts of the campus, though. The money was sent down, and we brought up a couple busloads of students, you know, a few from North Carolina, a few from Nashville, including Diana Nash, who is now married to James Bevel, Diana Nash Bevel, yeah, who is one of the leaders of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. There were a lot of people, both North and South, who became nationally prominent leaders in the civil rights movement. At the northern fringes here, the northern student movement, which grew out of this little telephone chain, became an actual movement. And at least according to the lore, and it's difficult to pin this down because none of these groups ever have a historian. They don't keep membership records for more than a couple of hours at a time. So unless somebody were to do some arduous research, it would be tough to prove one way or the other. But the lore is that the Northern Student Movement was the antecedents of the Students of Democratic Society. And there were a lot of overlapping faces and names, and it's probably a very apt thing to say. Mm-hmm. Certainly lends drama to the whole history of the, or at least the after the fact of what we were doing here in the very quiet days of the late 50s, early 60s.
You mentioned the Green Lantern on the phone. Were you a member of it?
Yeah, the Green Lantern was one of two or three beacons where the students that mattered on the left and the liberal students were sort of to be found one way or another. The Green Lantern was then where the chemistry building is now. It was a two-story and a very large basement, maybe three-story building, that had been donated by an economics professor, Groves, to act as a working laboratory to prove the effectiveness of the co-op as an economic tool. And it worked very effectively. It was run continuously by students for many, many, many years. You know, a couple of generations. Well, it could have been a couple of generations, but for a couple of decades, mm-hmm. The upper stories were a female independent dormitory administered only by the female students. And the basement was the Green Lantern. And that, again, was all run by students. And I was an active member and treasurer for 1 year. The 1 year we made money. That just shows what happens when you put a working class treasurer in. Boy, did we have paperwork there. We had to refund all the money we had made. Otherwise, we'd pay taxes on it. And we certainly did not want to pay taxes. The Green Lantern we had about 135 members I can't remember what it was now. It was even then a very nominal weekly fee. You would get six meals, your lunch and dinner, Monday through Saturday. And you would work 3 hours setting table, clearing table, helping in the kitchen. If you were one of the officers, you didn't have to work because you were putting in many more than 3 hours of work anyway. And the student politicians would always come there to practice because the members there were pretty hostile to student government in general, just on general principles. It was regarded as a Mickey Mouse thing that didn't matter very much. So they would really razz the hell out of any of the campus political types who would come there to give their speech. And it was great training for them then to go off and give their same speech to a fraternity or a dormitory. And pretty quick, the institution was so entrenched that it was more like a Second City or Saturday Night Live performance. Each Green Lantern member was trying to outdo the other one in making life thoroughly intolerable for whichever political speaker was speaking there. The foreign students, regardless of politics, were also there because they felt very comfortable. Was the only place on campus where discrimination didn't exist. Even people being overly curious about your social antecedents. You know, the people there felt very comfortable with Iraqis and Iranians and Greeks, and so the foreign students just gravitated to the place. The final highlight I can remember about the Green Lantern, which I, interestingly enough, my stepson was probably their last treasurer. I understand from him that they have since dissolved, ironically, to avoid an immense tax assessment that the state government levied on them. They decided retroactively that they should have been paying sales tax, probably from the years back when I was treasurer. But I think it was my final year there. We were apprised of the fact that the new chemistry building was someday in the foreseeable future going to replace the Green Lanterns building. And it was unlikely we could find another suitable quarters. We did not have any substantial equity in that building. Certainly no private funds at the end of the McCarthy era would back something like that. Somebody had the brilliant idea to go out to Taliesin and put the idea to Frank Lloyd Wright. It was well known he hated the architecture on the campus. He and most bureaucrats were at each other's throat continuously, just on principle, if nothing else. So we wrote and then telephoned and set up an appointment with the grand old man who showed up. We sat on some of his own chairs out in the lawn. And he only listened about 5 minutes, and he very quickly sized up exactly what we were there for. And he held up one hand and he says, "I know what you're here for." He says, "You know, I don't like that goddamn campus any more than you probably do." He said, "It's a," forget exactly his language, I can only do it half as colorfully as he, but he painted a vivid picture of how disgusting he felt the architecture on campus was. And he says, "You're also as poor as can be, and you got nobody who's going to build this building for you, and you want me to do it for you, right?" Everybody sort of felt, well, he's seen through us, and there goes the whole ploy. He said, "Well, damn it, let's do it." He said, "I'll make all the arrangements." And he died a few months later, yeah, before anything, you know, could get started.
A sad story.
It would have been so much fun to come back and find this Frank Lloyd Wright building on campus, and that it should be the continuation of this Groves dormitory and the Green Lantern Co-op. I'm not convinced that today's students would be able to carry it on with the sort of continuity it always had then. There was a certain kind of appreciation for the value that something like had. Everybody there was either spending their own money or spending money they had watched their parents earn, not necessarily easily, and they spent it that way. The Green Lantern was their way to get decent food at decent prices and have a good time too. And maybe it's just because my arteries are hardening or my sensitivity is becoming cynical, but I just don't sense that in the students today. I don't think that it could be carried on that way. In fact, I saw it in my stepson Jeffrey when he was treasurer there. It was a thankless job. Whereas when I was treasurer, there was a lot of paperwork, but it was never a thankless job. There was always somebody there. If the paperwork got to be too much, even if it wasn't their job, they would pitch in and they would say, "My God, you know, you ought to get two meals a day for all that the red tape you got to put up with." There was none of that anymore the last year that he was treasurer. But it sure would have been fun to have Frank Lloyd Wright's building there. I think I'm about talked out for now.
What happened to you afterward, just briefly?
Well, in 25 words or less, I graduated the summer of 1960. The following day, I didn't really graduate. I just sort of finished my last class and left without any fanfare for New York City with my wife and daughter in a very old anyway, green Plymouth that chugged along. I was going to make it in the mass media, which was my way to change society, of course. I did. I have written 22 books. A syndicated columnist now. I influenced maybe 20, 25 million people.
Your books are about what?
Oh, whatever damn thing interested me. I'm just as eclectic as I was when I was a student. My first book was How to Fix Lawnmowers. Still in print after 15 years. Second book was called How to Fix Damn Near Everything. That was sort of a iconoclastic approach to how to fix the things you wish wouldn't break, but because the stupid manufacturers make them to break, they're going to break, so you might as well accept the fact they're going to break, and here's how you fix the damn things. And I moved into a little more graceful things, such as how to design your own furniture and build it, and how to design children's toys and build them. Then I teamed up with a writer who I met in New York City, and we started writing books on writing in English, did an English composition textbook, and a whole stack of books for students on how to study and take tests and take notes, how to cope with the stupid world around them. Wrote magazine articles for everybody from Fortune magazine to McCall's. Of course, in New York, I was a very active member of Brooklyn Core. Even before that, I ended up in the South, but I very seldom talk about that because I end up breaking down, crying.
Civil rights movement.
Yeah, they were not pleasant days. And ended up back in Madison because I just delight in the place.
An expert in computers.
That's what everybody says. Like everything else I did, I learned it with no help from the school. I think the only course through all of my grade school, high school, and college that I use with any regularity was typing. I don't think any of my sociology sank in. My chemistry is 30 years obsolete. My 15-year-old son is studying high school chemistry now, and it's more theoretical even than the physical chemistry that I studied then. And certainly the psychology and the philosophy was not of much value even then, and 30 years later is of no value. So my days in college were spent finding out for myself by sticking my nose in where nobody really wanted it, and that's what I'm doing right now.
Oh, now it's right where everybody wants it, I'd say, if you're writing on computers, but I can see what you mean about college.
My partner and I are probably the only computer people in the country who say, do you really need a computer? We refer to the computer industry as an immense shell game that nobody has been bright enough yet to see through. We're going at that very much the same way as I went at everything here, too.
Are you still a socialist?
I think I'm as much a socialist as Ronald Reagan. I think socialism is irrelevant. What we were talking about, socialism in 57, 58, 59, and 60, seems very peculiar right now. We've gone through the Johnson Great Society and the Kennedy War on the poverty, and we've had a chance now to look at real socialism, not in the textbooks and not in the history books, but in Cuba, and we've seen that it's worked very well there. We've seen it work in China, and it's had some mixed results there. We've seen it in the Soviet Union, and many people wonder at the fact the Soviet Union survived it, and we've seen a whole different kind of it practically bankrupt many of the Scandinavian countries. just isn't relevant to today. Not what we were talking about. There are there are still many things that are to be talked about and learned about and worked for. If I'm around left-wingers, I bill myself as a conservative, and if I'm around conservatives, I bill myself as a socialist. If I'm around the very religious, I'm an atheist, and if I'm around atheists, I'm very religious. I think that capitalism and socialism both benefit from somebody kicking him in the ass. So I guess were you to ask me what I enjoy doing best, it would be kicking people's ass. Does them all a lot of good.
A modern version of being a gadfly.
Yeah.
Well, that seems to be a good place to end then.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.